folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCRIT Podcast. So yes, indeed, this is the MCRIT Podcast. But interestingly enough, this is also the inaugural episode of the Resus Me Podcast. Now, what am I talking about here? Well, you might remember in a previous podcast, you were introduced to Cliff Reed. Cliff Reed is a pre-hospital physician trained in emergency medicine and critical care. He has an astoundingly good blog at resus.me. Cliff is down in Australia, but he's originally a Brit. And he had a post on NAP4, and I'll explain what that is in just a moment. And I saw this post and I said, Cliff, why don't I interview you on the NAP4 post? And he did me one better. He found one of the authors and primary participants of the NAP4 section on emergency medicine and critical care and had already set up an interview as the first podcast coming out of Cliff's blog. Now, he was kind enough to let me be a fly on the wall during the interview, and then reproduce it for you here. So this is the MCRIT Podcast and the Resus Me Podcast. So you'll be hearing two other voices. You'll be hearing Cliff Reed, and then you'll be hearing a gentleman named Jonathan Benger, a professor of emergency medicine with a particular interest in airway management. And he was one of the committee members on NAP4. Now, Cliff and Dr. Benger are going to explain what that is in greater detail, but anesthetists of the National Health Service in Great Britain reviewed all the airways that went wrong and put them into a report with quantitative data and recommendations. You have to check it out. It's in the show notes. And I think you'll appreciate why. It's just incredibly important that the take-home messages of this project are heard by as many people as possible. Now, this podcast is just a bit longer than most. This one will be probably around 30 minutes. I think it's worth it. If you have to take it in two shots, then you just knock yourself out. I just wanted to inject two things before we get started. First, there is an incredible conference in Cape Town, South Africa. It's called Emergency Medicine in the Developing World. It has luminaries like Joe Lex, Mike Winters, Rob Rogers. I'm kicking myself now because I was invited to speak there, and because of the new baby, I declined, and now I'm regretting it because it looks incredible. If you're interested, check out the link in the show notes for the full details. And then the second thing before we get started is, since we recorded this podcast, Cliff Reed has actually recorded another episode of his podcast, and I have a link for you in the show notes. Please go check it out because he has done a phenomenal job. There's also instructions in the show notes how to subscribe to Cliff's podcast in iTunes while he's still pending approval for an official iTunes link. All right, enough of this. Let's get started.
Professor Benger, NAP4, what does that stand for?
It's the National Anesthesia Audit Project. So the Royal College of Anesthetists have done a series of national anesthesia-based audits, and this is the fourth project that they've run, this one in collaboration with the Difficult Airway Society.
Obviously, in emergency medicine, critical care, we're interested in airway management, but anesthesia, I mean, isn't it all very different up there in the operating room? How is this relevant to what we do?
Well, I would agree that there are marked differences between planned anesthesia in an operating room and anesthesia outside the operating room. And at one of the very early meetings, there was a lot of discussion around the possibilities of extending the scope of the project. It had originally been conceived as being a purely operating theatre-based project, but both myself and colleagues from the critical care background felt that there would be a lot of value in including anesthesia anywhere in the hospital. Obviously, we made a convincing case because that was what the project leads agreed. So, in effect, we were really looking for any major airway complication that was occurring in the operating theatre, in the operating room, or in the critical care, intensive care environment, or in the emergency department.
I guess for those who know you, it's no surprise that you were involved in the emergency medicine critical care end of this. Could you tell us a little bit about your own background in the development of emergency airway management in the UK?
Well, I've always had an interest in emergency airway management since I was well advised during my training and spent some time in anaesthesia and critical care. And really carried that forward as a major part of my training, and have been fortunate that the college have given me the opportunity to work through that. So I've been instrumental in introducing a course in the UK called the Training in Emergency Airway Management course, a TEAM course, which is a course specifically designed for people with basic anaesthetic knowledge, perhaps who've done 6 to 12 months of anaesthesia and critical care, but who may be called upon to manage the airway in an emergency situation. And I've been quite involved with sedation and anaesthetic policy. And we're doing some work at the moment between the College of Emergency Medicine and the Royal College of Anaesthetists looking at emergency department sedation and anaesthesia. And we're hoping to produce some recommendations, some joint recommendations between the two colleges later this year.
So coming to the nitty-gritty of NAP4 then, what were the main learning points from the out-of-theatre airway management? So in the ED and the ICU, what are the take-home messages for us?
The take-home messages are that, as you would expect, it's dangerous, and there is a significant rate of complications. What the main project was able to do is come up with both a numerator and a denominator, and therefore estimate the frequency with which major complications occur in an anaesthetic room. It's much harder to be clear about what the denominator is in intensive care and emergency departments. So what we know is that there were a number of significant events and that the case fatality rate was much higher. So in fact, it was highest in critical care and then second highest in emergency departments and lowest in anaesthesia environments. So there is a clear risk of major complications, and those complications are more likely to be fatal. And I think that's perhaps one of the key messages to take away, is that if you undertake advanced airway management outside the operating theatre, you're working in a difficult environment where the risks are significantly higher to the patients involved. And I think that means that we need to make sure that the standard of care is as high as is feasibly possible in those environments.
So I'm going to keep chucking in these little asides that I added post-interview. Already great stuff. We've known this intuitively, but now we have some hard numbers that airway management in the ED and the ICUs is not the same as in the operating room. It's more difficult. You're going to have more potential for disaster, and you need to be even more diligent having a good plan for when things go wrong.
The second key point that's come out of the project, I think, it relates to capnography. And it's absolutely clear that capnography as a universal tool in any patient who is intubated is appropriate. And unfortunately, it's the case that for a variety of reasons, capnography is not universally used in critical care in the UK, and it's not universally used in emergency departments in the UK. And it's absolutely clear that if you don't use capnography in advanced airway management, intubation, tracheostomy care, etc., then there is an increased risk to patients as a result of complications. And the obvious one, of course, is unrecognized esophageal intubation. But a lot of the cases that occurred in the critical care environment with displaced tracheostomies could have been resolved more promptly had capnography been in use.
That's disturbing to hear that capnography isn't in widespread use in 2010, 2011 in UK emergency departments.
Whether it's in widespread use or not, I'm not sure. And in fact, one of the projects that I'm addressing immediately is to try and estimate what the how prevalent its use is. And I'm just actually literally at this moment today working on a national survey to try and quantify how frequently capnography is used. What was interesting in some of the cases in NAP4 was that capnography was present, but wasn't applied, and that's particularly concerning because probably the same individual working in operating theatre would routinely use capnography, but for some reason in a different environment, they've chosen not to use the capnography, and that might be because they don't realise it's available, or they don't feel able to ask for capnography, or they believe that a different standard is acceptable in that particular environment. And I think there is inevitably a problem when practitioners who normally work in one environment move into a different environment and asked to visit an emergency room in order to undertake a complex anaesthetic case, then that puts them at a disadvantage and they may feel nervous, uncomfortable, a bit out of their depth. And I think that in turn might lead to changes in practice which are not ideal. And that's one of the complex parts of the debate around emergency physicians undertaking airway management versus anaesthetists. One of the advantages of emergency physicians is that they're familiar and comfortable in the environment. And if you want to invite others who don't normally work in that environment into that space, then they may become more uncomfortable, and their practice may change as a result.
Absolutely. For those listeners that haven't seen the NAP4 document, I highly recommend you take a look. We'll put the link to the document, which is freely available. And it contains many specific cases that are well described, and it's very, very powerful way of learning from other people's cases when you read these descriptions. One of the things that seems to come up several times in the document is the use of capnography in cardiac arrest. Do you want to go into some detail there?
Yeah, we found that there was a universal failure to understand capnography in low output states and cardiac arrest. And in all environments, so in anaesthesia and critical care and emergency medicine, there were cases where a flat trap capnograph trace was interpreted as indicating cardiac arrest or being consistent with cardiac arrest, rather than either a tube in the wrong place or a tube that's entirely obstructed. And obviously, these are all major complications, and cardiac arrest was not uncommon, usually secondary to hypoxia. And with the patient was in cardiac arrest, and the capnograph showed a flat line with a reading of zero, then a whole range of practitioners interpreted the flat line as being due to the cardiac arrest. In fact, I think if one works in emergency medicine and routinely uses capnography in all intubated patients, as I do in my own practice, then you get very used to the fact that the capnograph trace is very powerful in cardiac arrest because it's an immediate feedback on the quality of CPR. It's a good prognostic indicator of the chance of recovery from cardiac arrest, and it's the first thing to change when the patient's circulation returns, in that the capnograph will show some spike of carbon dioxide as circulation is re-established. And what was surprising to me is that it was quite a widely held belief that the capnograph would be flat in cardiac arrest, even if good quality CPR was ongoing. And these patients are generally just arrested, so they would have very good CO2 production if good quality CPR was applied. And I guess that that's a question about one's normal practice. So in anaesthesia, cardiac arrest is very rare. Whereas in emergency medicine, cardiac arrest is very common. And as I say, if you get in the habit of applying capnography to every tracheal tube, then you become a lot more familiar with the capnograph trace in low output states. Almost all of the cases were esophageal intubated, but there was one case where the tracheal tube was entirely obstructed. And again, that was interpreted as being due to cardiac arrest, when in fact the tube is obstructed by blood.
Absolutely. I have to say I share your bewilderment at the perpetuation of this dogma that the capnography trace can be flat in an correctly intubated cardiac arrest patient. I continue to hear that propagated from trainees and also specialist colleagues. And in my own practice too, I've applied waveform capnography to every cardiac arrest I've managed pre-hospital and in hospital for the last 9 years, and I've never seen a completely flat trace. I suspect if you intubated Tutankhamun, you might get a flat trace, but in the cardiac arrest I've seen, you always get a waveform and you always get a number.
So just to pound home what Dr. Benger and Cliff have said, if you are in an ED or an ICU or on an ambulance and you are intubating without waveform capnography, I don't mean color change capnometry, I mean waveform capnography, you are doing your patients a disservice. This should be standard care for any intubation in the three environments I just mentioned. Now, once you have waveform capnography, if you do not see a waveform, it means the patient is not getting ventilations, no matter what circumstance they're in, whether their cardiac output is low, whether they're in frank arrest. Unless your patient is in rigor mortis, they will generate a waveform if the endotracheal tube is in the right place and not obstructed.
There was some stuff on the can't intubate, can't ventilate scenario that we all dread, particularly with reference to the difference between needle cricothyroidotomy and surgical cricothyroidotomy. Could you explain that?
Yes. Obviously, surgical airway was one of the mandatory reporting criteria if that was unplanned. So if the plan from the outset was to do a primary surgical airway, then we didn't include those cases. But if the plan was to do something different and a surgical airway then followed because the first plan had failed, then we included those cases. And there was a striking difference in the success rate between any cannula technique to enter the trachea compared to any surgical technique. And by cannula technique, I would include wide-bore cannula techniques. So there are a lot of kind of kits on the market that put a cuffed or uncuffed wide-bore cannula into the trachea, usually using some kind of needle or Seldinger technique. And they all seem to be less successful than an open surgical approach using, basically using a knife. And so, for example, in the emergency department, there were three patients where there was an attempted needle airway, and they were all unsuccessful and had to be converted to a surgical airway. And very similarly in the operating theatre, a lot of the attempts to enter the trachea, usually the cricothyroid membrane, with a needle or wide bore cannula were unsuccessful, and there was some barotrauma, difficulty maintaining airflow, and a lot of those patients needed conversion. And there were similar findings in the critical care unit as well. Now, it's a complicated area because a lot of the surgical airways were done by kind of card-carrying surgeons. So for particular cases in the operating theatre, a surgeon might have been already available. A lot of the cases in the operating theatre were ENT and head and neck cases where the patient was a high risk of airway obstruction. So in some respects, you'd expect surgical airway to be highly effective in the hands of people who do that work all the time. But obviously in the emergency department, there wasn't the availability of a surgeon, but there was the availability of an emergency physician. And the success rates were in excess of 90% for surgical approach to the trachea, and significantly less, more like 50%, in patients where a needle approach was attempted. And in fact, if one looks at the broader literature, that's consistent with previous reports comparing cannula techniques to open surgical techniques. Now, it's a difficult area, but I think one has to take note of that. And whilst there is, I think, a lot of reluctance from people who don't routinely use a scalpel to open the airway with a scalpel, this, added to previous evidence, does provide strong support for using surgical access as the primary and initial route, particularly if that's a technique that an individual has practiced before. We know from that if you've done some practice in a simulator or other model, that your chances of success are actually very high.
That strikes me as an extremely important take-home message from the NAPFOR study, particularly in view of what's taught on many life support courses in managing the can't intubate, can't ventilate situation.
Gosh, do I love it when my prejudices are confirmed. I have always believed that the Seldinger technique needle cricothyrotomy kits, or even worse, the just jury-rigged grab a needle with a catheter over and attempt to use that for a cricothyrotomy method, they just don't work in real life. They're wonderful on the mannequins, and they fail when the chips are down. And now we have data to support that contention. If you are an emergency physician, you should be doing surgical cricothyrotomy with a blade. Now, my belief is that should be a bougie guided cricothyrotomy. I think it is, bar none, the easiest, most fail-proof method of performing a cricothyrotomy. But what you should not be doing is needle cricothyrotomy. Save it for the mannequins, not for the patients.
What about the patient in whom perhaps some features of a difficult airway suggest that rapid sequence induction would be hazardous or contraindicated? Does NAPFOR guide us in that area?
Well, one of the interesting findings in general was that awake fiber optic intubation was not used as much as it probably should have been. And obviously that particular technique depends on whether you have individuals with that skill set. And some patients are obviously not suitable by nature of their underlying pathology or lack of ability to cooperate with awake intubation techniques. But there's clearly a role for fiber optic techniques in selected patients. What was interesting from my perspective is that gas induction, for example, which is still widely kind of held as being an appropriate technique for management of patients with threatened airways, actually in a lot of cases it just led to loss of airway and wasn't as successful as one might hope. I think a lot of it's about being able to recognize patients with potential difficulty and making sure that the appropriate individuals with the appropriate skills are available. One of the key messages that came out of NAPFOR from an emergency department perspective was that junior trainees were attending the emergency department to manage the airway, and they were out of their depth. So there were two cases, for example, where very junior anaesthetic trainees were called as the anaesthetic assistants to the emergency department and then attempted to intubate adults with complex mid-face fractures, a lot of blood in the airway, and got into all sorts of trouble. And those individuals who needed intubating weren't necessarily particularly urgent. One of them was GCS-14 and was agitated, needed intubation for a CT scan, but didn't need it absolutely there and then. And interestingly, when help was called for, senior anaesthetic assistants arrived very promptly. So there wasn't a lack of support, but there was a lack of communication. And one of the things that struck the panel was that there's a problem in large hospitals with large teams where individuals aren't necessarily well known to each other. And an individual may arrive who's kind of the airway practitioner, and it may be difficult to establish immediately who they are, what their experience is, and whether they're appropriate to be managing the airway problem. And that individual, of course, may feel under pressure to manage the airway problem. So they've been called as a specialist. They don't necessarily want to look foolish in front of a large team of people by saying, actually, I can't manage, this is too difficult.
Oh, so much good stuff in that section. So first of all, awake intubation is underutilized in the emergency department. If you have an airway that is predicted to be difficult, or just by gestalt looks difficult, and the patient is not crash, meaning you have just a bit of time, then they should be done awake. And if you want to know how to do that, check the link in the show notes. Next thing, what's this gas induction that Dr. Benger mentions. Well, this is a kind of a stopgap measure the anesthesiologists sometimes use. They won't give the patient paralytics. They won't give them IV sedatives. They'll have them breathe down on inhaled anesthetic agents. And they'll try to intubate them then. And the idea is that if they can't, the patient will wake up relatively rapidly and be able to regain their airway. And as you heard Dr. Benger mention, that wasn't a great idea either. Then the junior's coming down. My gosh, if you as a trained emergency physician couldn't get an airway and you call for anesthesia backup and they send down a PGY2, that makes no sense. So if you haven't already, sit down with your chair or director of anesthesia and get across that if you're calling for help, it's going to be a tough airway. And the person who should be sent down is an anesthesia attending. That's what we have at our shops. That's what we want. Last, Dr. Benger mentions checklists and pre-planning to know what people you have available, what equipment you have available, and what you're going to do when the crap hits the fan. And gosh, how could you argue with that?
Scott, do you have additional points or questions?
So one of the striking things that came out of my reading of the document was the consistency with which mishaps occurred when there was no failure plan. These folks hadn't thought ahead what they were going to do if conventional laryngoscopy failed. And what it resulted in is multiple attempts at continued laryngoscopy. Could you comment on that a bit?
Yes. It's what we came to describe as failure to plan for failure. Even though the airway had been predicted to be difficult in some patients, the backup plan was often very poorly considered. And if it had been considered, then perhaps the equipment that was required to actually deliver the backup plan wasn't even present. So what then happened was that there was a tendency to repeat the same thing. So if laryngoscopy with a Macintosh blade was unsuccessful, then another attempt would be made with a Macintosh blade. And obviously, if intubation has failed the first time, then it's unlikely to succeed the second unless one has made some major changes to the situation in some fashion. And at the same time, a lot of these airways were quite threatened, and each attempt at intubation made things a little bit worse. There's a little bit more trauma and a little bit more swelling. Quite regularly, we saw a situation where the patient was initially could not be intubated but could be ventilated, and then multiple airway instrumentations followed, some of which were repeats of earlier airway instrumentations, and then the situation would deteriorate from can't intubate, can ventilate, to can't intubate and can't ventilate. And at that point, things obviously got even more problematic. So it was really a failure to plan for failure and have a clearly different backup plan that could be immediately enacted. And B, it was a tendency to repeat the same thing until the situation, as I say, deteriorated into can't intubate, can't ventilate.
I love that turn of phrase, failure to plan for failure. It's just perfect. It would seem one patient group that kept coming up that was particularly important in is the obese patient. The obese patient kept featuring in airway mishaps. Do you have any particular recommendations in that patient group?
Yeah, this is a very interesting area. I mean, you're right in that across the board, the rate of serious complications was clearly higher in obese patients. So about 50% of the patients were obese, and in the general population in the UK, about 20% of the patient population are obese. So clearly, there's a significant problem there. That means that obesity is an independent risk factor and needs to be taken into account. It also means that one needs to think about how one's going to approach the obese patient. Now, for those who do bariatric anesthesia on a regular basis, they would say that actually it's easy to intubate obese patients. And I think that that's probably because they do a lot of work in preparation and assessment and patient positioning. And so I think we could learn something there around how we position and prepare patients who are obese for anesthesia, and particularly in an emergency situation. Again, there's this kind of sort of odd idea that because it's an emergency, the normal standards don't have to apply. So capnography we've already discussed, but another one would be uses of pillows, for example. Obviously, pillows may not be possible to use pillows in trauma situations, but for non-traumatic intubation, then it always often strikes me as odd that we wouldn't dream of proceeding without a pillow in the operating theatre, but outside the operating theatre, it's okay to have not enough pillows or the patient's position being suboptimal. And so I think that that's a really key concept, is to take the time to get the positioning of the obese patient right, both in terms of their head and neck position to optimize the chances of successful intubation, and also to get the shoulders raised so that their diaphragm is unloaded and they've got more lung reserve to cope with. And there are other things. Obviously, pre-oxygenation needs to be much more thorough, and because desaturation is much faster. And so we probably don't pre-oxygenate people as thoroughly as we could. We could use non-invasive techniques, CPAP, to improve pre-oxygenation in obese patients. And as I say, positioning into a semi-recumbent position. I think all these kind of things would help. And then, of course, the other thing is I've already mentioned, things like awake fiber optic intubation and other techniques where the airway is predicted to be particularly difficult may be suitable alternatives.
Great. Well, thank you so much for going through that. I think NAP4 clearly was a massive amount of work by so many people.
Yeah, it was. I should just mention Tim Cook and Nick Woodall, who led the project. I mean, Tim and Nick were absolutely heroic in their efforts to deliver NAP4. I mean, it took more than 2 years to get this together, and the amount of work that they and my colleagues on the panel put in was very impressive. But I'm very proud of the results, because I think we've got some really useful information.
Yeah, and I'm sure you had no small part to play yourself, and hopefully we can get the message out, not just in the UK, but around other countries and other emergency physicians and critical care practitioners and anaesthetists, and hopefully save even more lives with the learning points of this document.
So again, folks, that was Cliff Reed, Jonathan Benger. Both of them have an amazing amount to contribute to the understanding of airway management in emergency medicine. So I'll leave you with that. Check out the show notes for all the links to the NAP4 stuff, and I will speak to you soon. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast, saying bye-bye.